Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about ways to create great recurring villains in your D&D campaign, while balancing the desire for epic showdowns versus the open-ended nature of an RPG campaign. Should your villains be untouchable masterminds or someone directly butting heads with your PCs? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin, as always, I'll remind everyone that at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. This is a live video chat hosted by Dan and I with all of our patrons joining in. And you can join in too, but just by becoming a patron. Visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. And a few minutes after the hour, around 2:10 Eastern time, we will be on there hosting the after-party chat. So come join us.
We love interacting with our patrons in the after chat, and we just have some of the best patrons here at Wandering DMs. And again, thanks to Vaquias for checking in that we are currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream. So we always appreciate that. What a great idea, Paul. And I know that you were talking with a friend about the recurring villains that is in their campaign, and this exact issue is coming up in my Star Frontiers campaign that I was running Friday night, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I want to frame
tricky,
this
right. Like, it's tricky in a role-playing game.
Yeah. We're going to very specifically talk here about very open-ended campaign play, right? We're not talking about one-shots or convention games or anything like that. We're talking about a campaign that is going to go on until we decide to stop, right? And that's sort of the interesting push-pull on this, I think, is that we want to create these stories that emulate the styles of media or fiction or whatever it is we're trying to emulate. And those things often include some kind of like main antagonist for the players to butt heads against. But when there's no foreseeable end, how do you have that desire to get to a point of climactic encounter with the end, the main boss, you know, if the game's not going to end immediately after that?
Exactly. And certainly from American adventure action movies, we expect that cathartic end fight with the tormentor. And we certainly expect that from modern video games as an expectation. You know, bearing in mind, you know, the real world doesn't generally give you that kind of closure all the time, frankly. And if we embrace the improvisation and the randomness that are built into our classic role-playing games, that might be slightly a fracture point, frankly, there. It might not fit quite the same way.
I mean, and you can even see this if you're running content where you expect there to be an end. It could be that you expect, yep, we're going to run for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, however long you're running your campaign, but I'm going to have this main villain that's going to appear throughout the campaign, and the end, the campaign is going to end when the players finally confront this main villain. That's still tricky to do, right? Because of player choice, right? Because you don't want this very railroading experience. It's very possible. What happens if that main villain is present, say, halfway through the game, and the players kill them? Like, now what?
I think that's very likely, right? I think I've tried, right? I've tried to have in-your-face villains with player characters, and it routinely turns out that they have so many... So, A, you know, players in our sci-fi fantasy games have so many options. They have so many abilities, and they also have so many really clever brains on their side of the table, that it's pretty likely that at some point they're going to come up with either some clever or just lucky stratagem to pick off your villain no matter what you want to do. So there could be a power or an ability or a cunning plan or just a really great, like one of your players goes crazy, makes a surprise attack and just gets really lucky. And there's so many ways that your, you know, Mary Sue villain can get taken out. I've seen it over and over again.
No, I thought it'd be interesting to look at a little bit at where this appears in pre-written material. Because this is where my investigation of this began. I was having a conversation with a friend and we were talking about The Enemy Within, which is a very long, multi-book campaign written for Warhammer Fantasy, which is the basis of the content for the 10 Dead Rats stream that we did a couple years ago. And the interesting thing about that is, in reading that content, I definitely get the impression that the writers did not have a plan for this. Right. So in the beginnings, you have this very interesting, the whole thing about Enemy Within, right, is that there's this plot going on, this secret plot. There are a lot of actors involved in it that are covert, right? There's the enemy within, that's within normal society. And it circles around possibly around the cult of the Purple Hand. The players are probably going to, throughout the course of this campaign, try to investigate that cult and who's behind it and who's pulling the strings, and is it even the Purple Hand themselves, or is there some greater enemy behind it all? And there's certainly plenty of twists and turns and odd like side quests and etc. within this campaign. But at the end, the question is, at the end, what happens? And the answer is nothing satisfying, in fact.
In fact, it's
a known issue with this campaign material, such that folks have rewritten the final book. I'm not even remembering what's in the actual printed book, because it is so unsatisfying to folks that it was rewritten by fans to be something totally different. And then most people, myself included, will even then improv an ending to it based on the way the players go, because who the players suspect is behind it is way more interesting than like who's really behind it.
Okay, let me ask this question, Paul, as not being an expert on Enemy Within. Do the books identify a specific leader mastermind?
The printed books, yes, they do. They do. And in the final book, the leader mastermind is a complete surprise. It comes out of nowhere. And I think there's a lot of, if you look up reviews of the content, a lot of people are very unsatisfied with that ending. They're like, it doesn't really make sense. There's no way that the players could have pieced it together. It's unsatisfying. It's weird. It's just strange, right? And so I've seen, if you look online for other folks who have run this in commentary and whatnot, they start to identify like, well, it could actually be this person. It could be this person. It could be this person. And maybe you want to be a little more fluid about who's really behind it based on the play, so that at the end, when it comes time to like lift the mask and reveal the final villain, you have some options. So you can like pick the one that's going to be most satisfying to play.
And
frankly, it's still not great. Honestly, it's still like I still come away from that content a little dissatisfied, where I'm like, I want it to make more sense. I want to understand better who these actors were and what their plans were, right? Because I feel like that's the real problem with this. If you don't know up front who the mastermind is when you're writing, season one, let's imagine you're breaking your content into season. If you don't know who the mastermind is who's going to be overthrown at the end of season five, and you're writing season one, like it's going to feel wooden and weird, I think.
Yeah, I see that. And you're making, and on the one hand, look, as human role playing referees, we have limited time. We don't have like a writing team that we can set out a 5-season book, right? And plus a sketch of the first season, plus 2 complete written episodes, like when you're doing a show pitch. We have limited time. So on the one hand, what do you focus your time on? Do you focus it on like, I just need to make a couple initial adventures and I'll fill it in later? Or do I, which feels wooden, there's no question about it, like you're saying, or do I sketch out the end goal of the final mastermind some great amount of time from now? It's kind of a dilemma there. But I remember like the 2000s Battlestar Galactica, frankly, that started with the Cylons have a plan. And, it didn't take too many episodes. I'm like, I really don't think they do. I really feel that this show is kind of drifting. There isn't kind of a direct line. And I'm pretty sure there really isn't a plan. And I can kind of detect that, and your players can detect that too, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. The real problem with the Enemy Within content, in my view, is that it starts off so strong. There are so many interesting, unexplained things happening. You really want to know what is happening here, what's going on. And they just don't follow through, right? By the end of it, there's not a nice bow on like, oh, it all makes sense now. I understand what this group was plotting or what that group was plotting and how they went awry of each other. Like, it just is, it just falls flat. So I was thinking about, like, how does content handle this? How do we handle it when we're running our games? How does movies and TV and books handle it? I think one trope that I see a lot is this idea that, like, you get to a point of finding the main antagonist of the person that's causing all the problems that your group is dealing with. And just in that moment where they deal with that person, whatever it is, kill them, imprison them, what have you, it is revealed secretly they were being controlled by this other group or person. And you go, there's something bigger going on, right? And that can be fun in the moment. But after a couple layers of that, it starts to feel really weird, right? It happens a little too often and you're like, okay, why? And the motivations of the group A that controls B, that controls C, that controls D, is just really hard to map out, man. Like, really? And if you like backwards apply logic, you think, really, this group put these plans into motion like this and they expected that to work? There's a lot of variables at play. Like, how is that possible?
Yeah,
so I'm thinking of things like, so for example, trying to rack my brain for examples of this, right? And so you have, like, say, the Star Wars, the original trilogy, the Star Wars, as I like to call it, right? So you start off with, like, okay, there's the evil empire, I don't know, stormtroopers, they seem bad. And then, okay, now they're being controlled by Darth Vader. Oh, he's a real pain in the ass. And then, oh, it turns out he's controlled by the Emperor. That's, you know, and that's really the, oh, and it comes back to the whole Empire, and that's terrible, and et cetera. And the interesting thing, I think, about this flow is that finally when it's resolved, and then you go, yes, but we want more Star Wars movies. How do we do more, please?
Yes.
Then the answer is, I don't know, prequels, I guess. Let's go back in time. And so we can still have those bad guys on the...
Do not like prequels. Yeah.
You know, like, another thing I think of is the show series Breaking Bad, which actually does this really well, I think. It has this series of villains that he's facing. You know, he's going through this organized crime group and, like, okay, just as I've overcome or defeated this person, I find out, oh, there's a kingpin higher up the chain. Now I have to deal with that person. And it does it well and in a satisfying way. But I think because I've always suspected that, I believe Breaking Bad kind of knew what the ending was going to be at the beginning. And so they wrote their series, and then it ends in this very satisfying way. And now we can't have more Breaking Bad. And people really wanted more Breaking Bad. And so how do we do that? We go to a prequel. Which was fine. It was good. Better Call Saul's great series. But, like, they had to go backwards. They could not go forwards because, like, you just be inventing something whole new, right? Yeah.
You know, let me make two side points. So one is that I have watched a number of series that I've been fond of in the past that wound up, like, okay, the series goes 1, 2, 3, 4 seasons, and it starts to drift a little bit, and the quality clearly is, like, doesn't quite have the energy, and the show is clearly about to wrap up. So the showrunners all of a sudden, like, pull out all the stops, right? And craft a really nice, like, not just go crazy, but craft a really nice, elaborate, satisfying endpoint and have a wonderful last season and a wonderful, really nice closure last episode. And this is so good that the producers ask for another season. It's so good that it gets them another season, and they have to unwind. They have to unwind the closure. Yeah. Right, and come up with a reason to go on, and it kind of sucks, right? And the fact that you've actually sabotaged your wonderful ending, and you have one final last kind of poop season, that crapped on your good ending. And I feel like Justice League Unlimited, I feel, did that, and some other shows, and it's really painful. Yep. I feel like Elementary had the same thing, had a wonderful what should have been the last episode, and they unwound it.
I feel like I haven't watched the series, but I've read the books. That Game of Thrones falls into this, right? And a Game of Thrones, okay. I feel like, is almost even worse because you know, again, layers upon layers of conspiracy and groups of impacting each other and random events happening, and to the point where he just wrote himself into a corner and just couldn't finish the series anymore. And so it just doesn't end. There's just no
passing,
right? I don't know. Let's go back to the beginning and start making it into a TV show, and then have the same problem eventually when we get towards the end of that season.
I think that the creation of the series is going to give me extra ideas, and as there's additional creative inputs, that clearly is going to inspire me to finally finish it. And then
here I am, right back where I started from. Ask you, let's go back to role-playing games. So as I was thinking about how this applied to Enemy Within, I was trying to think of other big campaigns that maybe have this issue. And my brain immediately went to the GDQ series, right? This is definitely a series of modules where, sure enough, you face off against what you think is the main threat, and then you unmask him and go, somebody else is in control.
Yes.
But I don't know the GDQ series super well, not nearly as well as you do. So I wanted to pose this question to you here in our show. Like, what happens? How does the GDQ series end? And is it satisfying, or is it equally like, I don't know. Somebody, I guess.
So,
some mastermind did something really bizarro.
So your point about the Enemy Within. So I started, when you asked this a couple days ago, I started digging in. I started thinking about all the examples of classic D&D type adventures. And I was like, well, that's unusual about the Enemy Within. And I was like, oh, geez, that exact same thing happens in this series. And then I was like, wait, that exact same thing happens in this other series. There's a lot. There's actually a lot. It's very common in early D&D series for this to be part of the structure, actually, is to have a mastermind who's completely off screen for the entire series and never detailed and never given a climactic end boss scene. And so the GDQ series is you know, the first series that TSR actually published for D&D is such a wonderful example about it, because it starts with the Giants trilogy, where the human above lands are being invaded by horrible giants, and you have to go. And I will point out that I think TV Tropes calls this the sorting algorithm of evil, right? Is you deal with one evil boss, A, right, which in this case are the Hill Giants, and well, they're controlled by the Frost Giants, and then they're controlled by the Fire Giants. And of course, one of the main, you know, elements that's made D&D what it is, and has, you know, given our good friend R.A. Salvatore an entire writing career, frankly, was having there's going to be some spoilers to 50-year-old adventures here. Just so you, if you don't want the spoilers here to classic adventures, turn it off now. So the fact that the giants themselves are being controlled by the mythical, never-before-seen drow elves from an elaborate Underdark, and thanks for pulling up, Paul. So then you go through the whole D series, going to basically the center of the earth through a bunch of things, and you finally wind up at the Vault of the Drow. And of course, the series is, you know, now known as the GDQ series, because the Vault of the Drow, and you can see it in the illustration here from this very early adventure there, is you actually do wind up in the final temple of the demon spider goddess Lolth. And if you pursue that, you actually wind up on her extra-dimensional demonic plane and finally face off against her. Here is the incredible screw job that's happening here. Lolth doesn't have anything to do with the initial invasion. Neither she nor her priesthood are controlling the giant invasion. That's actually instigated by an entirely different faction of renegade priestesses trying to promote a different deity at odds with them. And you have actually accidentally stumbled into the wrong place. And so if you actually confront Lolf, that's actually the wrong person. And the actual person controlling the invasion is a high priestess named Aklavdra. And technically, there's one very brief line in the book of what her stats would be and her companions in her noble house. But there's no map. There's no place. There's no defenses. There's no clues. There's no expectation that you're actually going to have a confrontation with Aklavdra, the person actually instigated it. It's a different person. It's a different being. So I don't know how many players have gone through the whole GDQ series and not realized that they confronted the wrong person. But that's actually how the series is set up.
That's
and
hilarious.
It's interesting. It's dramatic. I've run it. And the actual person never gets confronted in any scene there. So how wild is that?
Yeah. And so it just fizzles. You never get closure about what the hell really happened. That's super weird. That's super weird.
Right? Right? And I'll also say that, you know, Gary, again, these were initially tournament modules. Gary himself wrote the G trilogy, the D trilogy, and I guess had some sketchy notes for what should have happened with the final Lolf adventure. Ultimately handed it off to somebody else to actually finish it. So when those initial monochrome modules were printed, there wasn't any Q module. There wasn't any conclusion to it, kind of like Game of Thrones. And then a number of years later, he just handed it off to somebody else, and it has a very different tone. It has a very different structure, and it really doesn't feel like the other modules at all, but interesting in its own way.
Yeah. So I have some theories on how to tackle this, and I'm going to talk it out to you a little bit, Dan, and go with me on this ride. I think you're going to find we're going to go in a complete 360.
I'm so interested in that, but can I pitch a couple other examples? Because this isn't the only time that it happens in classic modules. The A series, right? The famous Against the Slaver series in D&D, and you and I have both run that. I've run it in conventions recently. If you follow the tournament, right, the tournament linear path for that, and you're pursuing, an outskirts place and then a closer post and then into the city and blah, blah, blah. The actual tournament, you never get a confrontation. You never get a final confrontation with the actual slave lords as pictured here on the cover of this particular module. This particular module ends with you confront them and then you're just automatically gassed. There's nothing you can do about it. You're automatically put down into the dungeons for the next module, and then there's actually no confrontation with them. The campaign version builds an option for that, but when I specifically ran through the tournament version, I have had criticism from my players saying, we remember that from a couple of years ago. Why didn't we get any final scene? Why didn't we actually get any final closure taking down the slave lords? Because it's not part of the tournament sequence. Right? And then, again, I'm currently running the Star Frontiers Volturnus campaign, and I was just running that Friday night, and hopefully none of my players are watching this at the moment. So interestingly, in this series, in the science fiction series, there's another organization running a slaver's operation also.
Of course there is.
And they are they're pirates. They're space pirates. And they are led by a mastermind known as the Star Devil. And everybody talks about him, and you get logs of reports reporting to him. And he's well-branded. Like, all the jackets, all the machines, all the vehicles have Star Devil branding on them. And nowhere detailed anywhere in the series. Not named, no stats, no location. Never appears anywhere in the entire series again. And my players are starting to run up very close to where they ought to be. Friday night, they were specifically asking, is the Star Devil in that compound? And the answer was, well, he actually has a suite. He has a wealthy suite he can stay at, but he's not there right now because he's actually not anywhere in the series. So again, I'm running up against this same. Clearly, that's that my players are now focused on this supervillain. That's the guy that they really want to eliminate them because he's been tormenting his forces have been tormenting him for months. And as written, he's nowhere to be gotten.
That's
isn't that funny that happens over and over again in these series?
Yeah. I think it's not surprising, because as I think about it, right, I feel like this is a problem that role playing content has been trying to solve for a long time, right? So I think about, like, it seems to me, in reaction to all that, what would I do? And like, I could see how it'd be very easy to come up with the argument of, like, well, the problem is that we just let this content grow organically. We started in a place with lots of mysteries. We didn't know the answers to them. And then we just wrote and wrote. And then we just kind of ran out of steam and it fizzled. What you really should do is plot it all out in front, right? Know the full arc, yeah, at least in a sketchy way, and then fill in all the details. And that's how we get stuff like Dragonlance, right? And that's, yes, how we get stuff, yes, that starts to feel like, oh, there's a plot line, and there's, you know, it makes sense, and gets super railroady, and maybe is like great for a novel and not so great for a role playing game. Mm-hmm. And then as I think about it, right, after I got frustrated with some of this content, I started, you know, around third edition, I switched to running a lot of Savage Worlds. There's a lot of Savage Worlds content from the, like, early aughts that came out in this time period that also tried to solve this problem. And they liked Savage Worlds content. Like, I'm thinking of stuff like Deadlands or, oh gosh, what was the superhero one? I'm forgetting the name of it. Anyway, so they made a lot of, Heroes, you know, a lot of no, it was, I mean, it's probably on my shelf right here if I bothered to look.
Champions?
It is
Necessary Evil. With my question. There you go.
Necessary Evil was the content. Okay. So this is all written for Savage. This is not a separate system. This is just content written for Savage Worlds. Right? Savage Worlds, generic role-playing game. This is a campaign for playing in a superhero world. And they liked to do a lot of stuff that was very, you know, they liked to have a twist, right? They liked a surprising twist in their content. Right? Necessary Evil, the gist of Necessary Evil is that you're like B-level superheroes. And the A-level superheroes all just got wiped out. No, I'm sorry. I'm totally wrong. You're B-level supervillains. And all the superheroes got wiped out by a whole new threat. And now you're the only ones who can come up and, like, save humanity. And now you're in this weird position of, like, I was trying to, like, take over the world, but now I actually have to be the hero because there's this other threat that we all agree is terrible. Right.
Yeah. Okay. It's actually, I like that.
It's actually kind of a clever setup.
Interesting.
And the other big one I would say is the Solomon Kane content. Like, that book. Here's an entire camp. I mean, this is a big fat book of content for playing in the Solomon Kane world. Solomon Kane, a character created by Robert E. Howard. Yeah, really fun content, kind of vaguely historical, supernatural stuff. Okay, what am I getting at? The way they set this up is they make these big major elements. They sketch out these okay, here are the big major plot points. And they even call it plot point. That's what they called it. Here are the major plot points of the campaign. And then here's little slices, little vignettes of other stuff that can happen. But we don't necessarily say that this has to happen in a specific order. And we give you, the GM, the ability to mix and match and shift things around as long as the players end up at the major inflection points. And it's very interesting because it's trying to give that illusion of choice when, in fact, there is none, right? Yeah. You start off, if you imagine as sort of this point graph, right? You still have this linear line of major plot points, but, like, it fans way out and then it collapses, right? And it fans way out and it collapses.
Yeah.
Right? Players can do a bunch of stuff, but eventually it's going to lead to this. And the problem with that is it still feels railroady. It doesn't work, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It still feels railroady.
Yeah. I believe it.
So here's my current working theory. You have to embrace the chaos. You have to embrace the idea that you can't know who the main villain is up front. It's just not possible. And what I would actually recommend, and this is based on me looking back at my own long-running BX D&D campaign, I'd started with L1, the Secret of Bone Hill, and I was like, okay.
You know, I was going to ask you about this. I actually wanted to ask you about this in the show, so thank you for bringing it up.
Great. Okay. So starting with L1, I said, like, the interesting thing is there's some major wizards here. You've got Peltar the Sorcerer in town, who's, like, a very helpful NPC. I like to make him a little double-sided in my games. Players kind of love to hate him, hate to love him. But he's generally helpful, and he's driving the the missions that the players are going on. And then you have a wizard named Tevlar, who's out in the wilderness and has got a castle full of bugbears and is clearly up to no good. What no good is he up to? We don't know. Not specified. Right? And so when I was running it, and I was trying to use this as like my starting point for a campaign, but I was trying to leave myself lots of space to explore and do new stuff, I thought Tevlar's going to be the main villain. And I was coming up, I came up with like a whole lot of stuff of like what he's up to and why he's on the outs with other wizards and, you know, what are his motivations, what kind of plans and evil ways is he going to machinate to screw with the players. And the players encountered him a few times. We actually even had a wonderful setup where they encountered him, and he almost TPK'd them, but one of the players cleverly decided to surrender, which was super fun.
Great.
Right. So I had this evil wizard kind of in play, but frankly, he fell a little flat. Like, he didn't last through the campaign. The players kind of got disinterested, did other stuff. They started to explore the larger world. And he just kind of fell to the wayside as a not very interesting person. So what did happen? Well, when I was creating the larger world that my L1 little sandbox lives in, I decided, okay, it's part of a larger kingdom. And I thought, oh, it'll be clever if that larger kingdom does not have one king, right? The king maybe has died, and now there is debate. The succession is in flux. And I came up with like two major princes, Hank and Gwei are their names. Prince Hank and Prince Gwei are actively fighting over who gets to control the kingdom. So kind of get this little War of the Roses kind of feel to it. And I made each one of them unique in different ways. One of them was like they're both ultimately power hungry, right? They both want to just take over the kingdom. They want to be in charge. They want to be crown king. One of them is very military minded, right? He's got his big army. He's marching around the countryside and he's just declaring martial law and being like, I'm in charge. Listen to me. Bend the knee. I win. The other one is more subtle. He's more interested in magic. He's making interesting little connections. He has little spy networks, etc. And he's doing whatever he can to undermine his brother and find a political way or possibly a magical way to forward his goal of becoming in charge. Here's the interesting thing about them. Neither one of these guys is necessarily specifically an adversary to the players. This is just context of the world that they live in, right? But the fact is, as my players played the game, they found the military warlord Prince Hank was just constantly getting in their way, and so they started to really despise him. And so then they started to find ways to back the other prince. And then, right, and so repeat it, like, over time, Prince Hank became the major villain of the campaign, not by design, but because the players chose into that and decided, we don't like what he's doing, you know, and then just start to interpret stuff, right? Then the Apophenia takes over, and they're like, he did this on purpose to screw us. Damn you, Hank. Right? I'm like, well, I was just making decisions about this NPC based on his goal. His goal is conquer my kingdom through military might. The end. That's my goal. It just rubbed the players absolutely the wrong way, and they loved to try and you know, push against him in any way they possibly could. So this is my theory on like good antagonist and recurring villain creation for your campaign is to don't try to make a good villain. Instead, make a couple interesting high-powered villains or organizations who have contrary goals, right? Who are maybe going to rub against each other. Give them very concrete goals, right? They want to do this thing. And then just root yourself in that. And let the players decide which one of them is the villain.
I think that's brilliant. I think that's brilliant, Paul. I hadn't thought this closely about this before you brought this up as a conversation point this week. And so probably 48 hours ago, I might not have said this, but I, having thought about it, I agree. I think that's a great way to put it. I think that, you know, some of our viewers in chat could anticipate this. Like Joshua a couple minutes ago said, some of the most fun is when the players spontaneously decide they really hate some guy. And then Joshua said, just have lots of horrible NPCs. They'll inevitably decide someone's their arch foe. And I agree, that happens. Not even you know, sometimes not even someone who you plan to be that terrible. I think I've had, you know, like a bureaucratic civil servant that was just like not very helpful and trying to follow the unhelpful laws and just blocking them in a lot of ways. And that, and someone that they can't just like immediately start stabbing. And that became like really hateful because it happened again and again and again. That became really, a, you know, sticking in their craw. And they started to really hate that guy. And I didn't intend him to be evil, but just unhelpful was enough.
Yeah, I think that makes for a better villain, honestly. I think that like if you set out to make a major villain who's like, my goal is to take over the world, to destroy all goodness, to like, you know, whatever, be the supreme being in the entire multiverse. It's not that great. When your villain, their goal is, I just hate my brother and I want everything he has. Like, that's a better villain.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
It's relatable. You can elaborate on that. There's a bunch of ways you can interface with it. It feels like the players legitimately are making a decision about whether to be allied or opposed him. With, you know, if the Cthulhu's showing up, I mean, unless you're insane, you're inherently opposed to them just by your nature as a being. But yeah, if it's someone that maybe could be allied or not, there's a lot more buy-in when they actually decide that that's someone they're allied or opposed with.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I noticed this even when I was running the Solomon Kane campaign content in Savage Worlds. I noticed this. I had some minor NPC who isn't even named in the content. He's just present. He's just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Whatever, has his own goals, and in the fight, he's like, you know, a minor lieutenant, an unnamed minor lieutenant in a group that the players are dealing with. And in that campaign, when I was running that, he escaped, right? He, for whatever reason, I think in the battle, he decided, oh, we're losing. I'm going to run away, right? And he ran away. And oh my gosh, the players just glommed onto him. They were like, I hate that guy. That guy is the worst. We're going to take him down. He must be very high in the organization. He must have a lot of control. He seems inferior, but it's clearly much more important. And I was like, he's a footnote in the book. He doesn't barely, I had to name him. I had to give him a name. But the players steam into it. So I was like, all right. And then frankly, I think I worked against myself by then pushing the content that's in the book rather than just running with, no, this guy's clearly in charge. This is the real bad guy.
So what a great observation. And I wanted to elaborate on exactly that point, Paul, so on the one hand, right, here's a mistake you can make in a classic role-playing game. I make a villain. They're going to be the centerpiece. They get in conflict with the players because I want that face-to-face interaction. I want them to taunt them. And when the time comes, by deus ex machina, they get away. That my villain will escape no matter what the players do. And I understand you're trying to make it feel like a movie or a novel. I get it. But the players will detect that. Your actual players will detect this. They actually have, you know, the game mechanics in front of them. They know what the rules look like. They know that they can't just wave their hands and demand to escape by fiat. So that when a DM does that, of my magical villain just gets away no matter what, that always feels bad, and it frankly flattens and wrecks the believability in the villain. So don't do that. Some systems, right? Some systems try to support that with something like fate points or luck points or karma points or something like that. And you'd think that would be okay. And I still, every time I've ever seen it, it doesn't seem to really work super well. But just like Paul said, if there's just some rando, right? You play it, you know, just use the standard rules. If you do have a villain, they should want to try to escape if things are going bad. Sure, they try to escape, but use the rules as written, use the standard mechanics that the players know about, roll the dice in the open, and if all that comes through, whether it's an actual leader or some rando, like in Paul's case, right, if they do escape, that's going to be highly memorable, and your players will hate that. They will hate that one guy that managed to luck out and get away, and you showed you weren't, you know, you weren't pulling the strings. The dice came up, they managed to get away, or maybe they have a legitimate spell that's actually on the books that they use the proper way, and yet that's going to become super memorable. That is who your players are going to think their arch villain is, and there's no way to pre-plan that.
Yeah. I mean, the nice thing too is it adapts well, right? Like if he's a rando and the players do just kill him, then oh well, he's a rando who got killed, and I guess he wasn't that important, right? But if he escapes and now the players have decided that NPC is important, great.
Yeah.
And I think it's important too when you're making these NPCs, right, again, is to kind of know their motivations, know what they're after, and think about how they would obtain those goals and pursue that. Don't pursue going after the players, right? Their goal is not, like, definitely do not make NPCs whose goal is to kill the players. That's boring, right? Give them some other goal unrelated to the players, and then you'll find yourself, like, there's interesting cases, I think, I've been in where the players are losing, right? The players are absolutely losing, and it's about to be a TPK. And I go, okay, well, what would this NPC do if they found that they had the upper hand and were winning? Would they necessarily kill these players, or do they have a better thing to do with them, right? Can they ransom them or blackmail them or imprison them or something? Like, is there some way by keeping the players alive that actually serves this NPC's goals? And that can lead to some very fun play.
Yes. Yes. Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah. Had another anecdote that I wanted to talk about. Now I'm forgetting. Oh, I had a great villain. Oh, just one of my most delightful villains, and I didn't get to play with them long enough, unfortunately. But my players had run afoul of a vampire, it was a female NPC vampire. I can't remember exactly what her motivations were, what she was up to, but the players ran afoul of her. And I think basically, I don't think she was even doing anything crazy. I think just the players like broke into her hideout and like robbed her, right? So now she's mad. Anyway, I had one player who was playing a wizard who decided it would be interesting. I can't remember how this came up, honestly. It might have just been like a random thing, like a charm spell gone awry. Anyway, he decided that his character had fallen in love with her. And he just played this. It was this very fun back and forth there of like, oh, I hate this villain because she does all these terrible things, but also deep down, I love her. And there's an interesting conflict for my character. Well, then what happened is this player had to leave the campaign just through life occurrences. He was like, I can't play anymore. I have to bow out of the campaign. And so I took his character and I had him join forces with the vampire and become a vampire. And I was like, I'm NPCing your character. And I did this with buy-in from the player. I'm like, look, when you leave, I'm going to take over your character. I'm going to make him an NPC and he's going to become a villain. And he was like, yep, fine. I'm into that. And so then once that player character suddenly now is a vampire and, you know, off in, you know, happily in a happy relationship with this other vampire, and they're going to go, you know, do whatever it is that they're going to do. It was a wonderfully personal villain for the players because they had played for so long with this character alongside them. And now he's flipped and now he's a villain. The interesting thing was, and maybe this is a metagame issue because they knew that this character had been previously played by a player. Then they were confused, right? They were like, well, what happens when Mike comes back to the table? Right? Should we kill this villain? Because then are we killing his character? Right? And so they just nice thing was I didn't want to resolve that for them because I'm like, good, you should feel conflicted about whether or not you should kill your friend. That's great.
Yes. Right. Yes. Yes. And you know, I've been doing that. I've been embracing that in my games recently too. Of there is, you know, maybe something you wouldn't even want to publish, maybe something, but, you know, awkward moral issues that are legitimately, I don't know, like I have an ally NPC demanding that they turn over prisoners for execution. And I just throw it on the table, and the players need to. I'm not aware of any good resolution to this, but I'm going to throw it out there, and the players have to grapple with it. And I feel that it's very, you know, it's very honest that that's a legitimate problem, and I am not there to relieve the anxiety. I'm not there to relieve the problem. The players have to work that out themselves. And a couple things happened Friday night that they had to deal with like that. And I don't mind throwing stuff without a clean solution to my knowledge in front of them. And that actually makes for a really interesting play. That's made for some really memorable, you know, good stuff lately, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a really good point.
So to boil it back, I would say that for me, if you're getting ready to run a campaign and you're doing a little upfront world building, the most interesting thing is to come up with probably more than one, right? Two, three, maybe four. In my case, I came up with two, and in retrospect, like three might have been great. Major NPCs who have very specific goals, who are maybe a little morally ambiguous, right? Are going to do some. They're going to do whatever it is that they need to do to pursue their own goals, right? Hopefully, goals that are maybe a little contrary to each other, so that those NPCs will be necessarily in conflict with each other, and then just get them in the world and have them start doing stuff and having it push things around. You know, the players will bump their heads into it, and then they will decide who in that you know, major NPC power relationship I think is good and just, and who is evil and needs to be destroyed.
I agree with that. The biggest emotional buy-in that I've seen from players has generally been surprises to me, and discovering that in the series of the campaign in a way that you couldn't have pre-planned or even guessed. It's a really weird thing. It's a really weird thing about this hobby, this improvisational hobby, that the best parts of it are this magical combination of what you, the DM, has put forth as a world and what the players interact in ways that you couldn't foresee. And that actually always gets the highest emotional content, and that gives you an opportunity to dig into it. You know, but it's something you have to embrace on the fly. And I agree, that's definitely what's gotten the best impact in my game, certainly.
All right, since we're in such agreement on this, Dan. Yeah.
I mean, if we go all the way back to, like, Castle Greyhawk, right? Gary's Castle Greyhawk, mm-hmm. right? You know, there is a wizard Zagig, which is sort of his last name in reverse. There's a wizard, a mad, crazy wizard Zagig that made the dungeon and, you know, set the traps and puzzles and all kinds of things. And, you know, he's not around. He's not there anymore. Technically, he survives in the campaign, but maybe he has escalated to an extra dimensional space in some way. We said it a number of times. Near the top of the hour, actually, I think it was David Heron who suggested this is why liches and abyssal villains work so well. They can usually come back, is one thing. So, you know, you might have a mastermind that's actually in a different space, in a different dimension, possibly, and then the players really, really can't get to them, at least to begin with.
Dan, this segues perfectly into the puzzler I was about to give you, which is this. Even though we agree, and it sounds like, you know, this is a great way to set up your villains, how do you handle the case when the players then, whether the villain was preconceived or you went through this improvisational way of creating this master villain, what happens when the players deal with it, right? When the players confront that villain, say, kill the villain, now what, right? Do I have to end my campaign? Is my campaign over? Do I just fall for the ha-ha, but you didn't realize this villain was under the control or influence of someone else?
I think that the campaign may be over. And, you know, the early role playing, like early D&D, was really held out as the campaign's going to go on forever. There wasn't any conversation about how long will the campaign go. It was just like, it's inherently open-ended. And so I think, and I might be wrong about this, but it's such a good question you posed, Paul, that with, you know, Castle Greyhawk could be extended ad infinitum, but the master controller is nowhere to be seen. And that's why it can go on potentially forever. I think that much like your Breaking Bad example, you do have to be aware that if this has gone on like this and this has become the theme, this villain, this now known villain has become the theme of the campaign, that might possibly, one way or the other, indicate the end of the game. And I think that's why, as I reflect on it, I actually am going to embrace these cases, these early series cases where the mastermind isn't anywhere in the adventure, like GDQ or the A-Series tournament or Volturnus. Or what about White Plume Mountain? Right, White Plume Mountain, there's a master wizard. They stole the artifacts. He left a taunting note. He talks to you by voice, not in the adventure, nowhere to be found. And so it does provide a number of things. It provides the players can't prematurely eliminate them, right? Can't catch you by surprise and end it. It gives you the opportunity for an ongoing campaign. And then it gives the DM the space to, when it feels like your campaign time is maybe running out, maybe that's the time the DM can step in and actually detail and place, and kind of like with your Enemy Within campaign, in a way along the path that the players have chosen, a possibly satisfying conclusion point. But I do think that if you've gone this long and there's a mastermind they've been thinking about, it's really hard for me to believe that you're going to step in and have a replacement sorting algorithm villain that is going to possibly be as satisfying as this, the one that they chose before themselves.
Here's an alternate opinion in the chat for you that I'm going to expand on here. So William says, so they killed the villain. There should hopefully be half a dozen other things going on for the PCs that they can continue to play if they want. They will eventually stumble into a new person to hate. I think this is a plausible direction, but I think I would still, first of all, I would check in, right? I would check in with the players and be like, look, you just killed the major villain. Like, yeah. This feels like the end. Yeah. Like, maybe this is the end. But also, like, if you're still like, no, we're all having a great time, we want to keep playing this campaign, I feel like I would still make a little coda here and say, like, well, this is the end of this season. And what we're mm-hmm, we can continue to play these characters in this world, but let's buy into the idea that with the continuation, the moving forward at this point, we're now in sequel land, right? We are now, there's going to be new villains and new things happening. And like, you know, I would make a beat there. I would like make a point of like, we have completed we've completed volume one. Now we can move into volume two if we so desire.
I think that's a really good point. And of course, William's point is excellent and on brand. I think you at least have to accept that there's a risk that it won't be successful. If this was the theme that has been really driving it up until now, and I've seen adventures, you know, suggest that here's possibilities for expanding campaigns. I think I've tried that once or twice, and I think I'll admit, you know, maybe there's better DMs than me out there. I think I myself have attempted it and have it not be as successful as I wanted it to be. So when you do lose that driving theme, you know, feel free to try that. And if you have great ideas and great players, go ahead. There's at least a risk that you're not going to recapture the first season energy.
Yep.
So
yep.
Do be aware of that.
Yeah, I think you're dead on there, Dan. Right? Like, and that's why I think like it's important to, you know, take the moment to say like, this is a new thing. We're embarking on a new thing now, right? Even if it is the same characters in the same world with the same DM, and even if we're going to pick up linearly, like right in time, right after we left off, you're still starting something new. And you know, it could be, if you don't do that, I feel like you are signing up for potentially a letdown of like, oh, it was never as good after we got to that point.
I agree. So sketching it out, not having a pre-planned endpoint, but then when you feel, for whatever reason, the campaign may be desiring a closing point, that's your opportunity then to actually put them on stage to detail them in a way that makes sense for this particular campaign. It could be different if you had different players, and maybe that's something you can synchronize. Actually, maybe that will be the closure of your campaign. It's an option. You don't want to get into the Justice League Unlimited zone of like, that was so great, I'm going to have a crappy afterlog. just be aware of that possibility.
Yeah. And we are out of time. I feel like that's good, honestly. I feel like we've wrapped this topic up. pretty well. But do you have any final thoughts to add on villain creation for your ongoing campaign?
This has been a great thing to reflect about that I hadn't thought about personally in my own gaming. I think I kind of like this off-screen mastermind villain that's left sketchy and is going to become, you know, more in focus as the campaign goes on. I think the DM should probably embrace finding out who the player's villains are in play. Find out if there's someone that you didn't expect that they really hate. And then if you do have a mastermind like these early series, you know, then you can make them touchable at an appropriate time, maybe when you know the end of your campaign is coming. I think that's a really strong design choice.
Yeah, I could see that. And don't be afraid to end it, right? I feel like, you know, even though we're talking about ostensibly the setup of we're playing an ongoing campaign, the whole idea is to not have an ending. I think it's still okay to let the game find an ending, right? If the game has found an ending, I would say embrace it and run with it. Don't push against it. No, I want more. That's great. It's great that you want more. Play something else. Play another, you know, play a sequel or play another campaign, or, you know, take the energy and move forward. But, you know, just trying to drag it on just for the sake of dragging it on, I think is going to fall flat, I think. So yeah, embrace it. Find your
end. And I fought that in the past, but the truth is nothing lasts forever, and it probably is better to honestly say out loud that it's actually, you know, a particular thing is actually ending at some point, and, you know, recognize that. And that, I think that's probably better than it just petering out.
Viewers, if you have opinions on how to get good, satisfying villains or villainous organizations or antagonists for your players in your ongoing role-playing game, leave us some comments here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. And maybe you have a different opinion or an interesting example of some way this worked out for you in play, something that Dan and I can be inspired by and bring to our next conversation.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. So please look for us there and unleash that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find our podcast through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. We couldn't do what we do without your support. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the hour, you'll see our different tiers. Every tier gets you access to a private Discord server where the conversation about science fiction and old school role playing and old D&D and new D&D and miniatures and wargaming is happening 24/7 around the clock. And we will be there in about 10 minutes for our live video after chat with our patrons. We would love to see you there if you're a first-time comer. We have a great conversation. I already have a couple things that I want to respond to in the chat, actually, that we didn't get in the hour. So thank goodness we have that video after chat here today, Paul. So normally we have a bit of a season break near the end of the year. We're going to have one more episode next week where we're going to do a review of our sixth season, as amazing as that is, here in 2024. So we will, if you have thoughts about your favorite things from the season, we would love to see you pitch them at us either on our Discord server or in the chat next week. So don't forget, we're live almost every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, and we hope that you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.